I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Could it be the first al-Qaeda cell in the U.S. since the 9/11 attacks? Authorities have charged an Afghanistan-born man, his father, and a New York City imam with lying to authorities during a terrorism investigation. Authorities believe Najibullah Zazi, a 24-year-old airport shuttle driver and legal resident of Colorado, was involved in a bomb plot. He drove to New York on September 10th, and authorities say he left bomb-making notes behind in a rental car and fled the city after he was tipped off by that New York City imam. James Meek is national security reporter for the New York Daily News. James, the Justice Department doesn't have specifics of a bomb plot, so why the arrest now?
Well, they've been interviewing Najibullah Zazi for several days last week about his travels to Pakistan, where he admitted to the FBI that he received weapons and explosives trainings from al-Qaeda in the federally administered tribal areas of Pakistan, which, of course, is where al-Qaeda's leadership has migrated as they have left the cities over the years under the protection of Pashtun warlords and the Pashtun-based Taliban, and that's where they have training camps. So this guy's admitted going there only a year ago, coincidentally, just as President Bush was beginning this offensive that President Obama has continued to hit al-Qaeda targets in those tribal areas with missile strikes. Anyway, this guy came back here and according to the FBI, was plotting to use some sort of improvised explosive device, or devices, plural, to attack targets. But as you point out, they don't know what the targets necessarily would be or how they would actually carry out the attack.
Well, the Denver Post reports that Zazi told them that he didn't admit to any of that, going to training camps in Pakistan. And he claims he accidentally downloaded these bomb-making notes that were found on a laptop that he left behind in a rental car as part of a religious book he was downloading. First of all, it's astonishing that someone would leave behind a laptop with bomb-making notes if, in fact, that was his intent. But was it that laptop that forced officials to move?
No, they've been watching this guy for some time with surveillance and wiretaps. They may have even, it's possible, followed him to Pakistan. He's made two trips in the last year alone. Again, a year ago, he, according to the FBI, admits that he received al-Qaeda training in weapons and explosives. So, yeah, he's denied it publicly, but certainly there is evidence here that suggests this guy is, in fact, part of the first al-Qaeda cell discovered in the U.S. since 9/11.
Well, let's talk about the imam, Ahmed Afzali. He had been working with police, giving them information since the 9/11 attacks, but police say he's the one who tipped off Zazi that the authorities were on his tail, and then also lied to authorities about the fact that he tipped Zazi off. Tell us more about him.
My sources tell me that Imam Afzali is somebody they have real concerns about, beyond just the fact that after they visited him and they showed him this Najibullah Zazi's photo and he identified it, but then tipped off Zazi's father that the feds were onto him, which caused sort of a chain reaction. It was certainly odd when Imam Afzali spoke to Najibullah Zazi by phone on September 11th, according to the transcript of the wiretap, and asked him about his last trip to Pakistan and then asked him if he had any, quote, evidence in your car.
Well, as we mentioned, Zazi is an airport shuttle driver. He's been in the U.S. since he was 14. He's 24 now. He's legally in the U.S. What fears are being raised about the fact that this is potentially a westernized al-Qaeda militant?
I don't know how westernized he is. I mean, what was really interesting to me about this, Robin, is that he's Afghan, and even more interestingly, he's a Pashtun tribal member, because we've never had Afghans in the hierarchy or leadership of al-Qaeda, much less ever identified in external operations outside of South Asia and Central Asia. That is very intriguing that you might have somebody like that come back here and do something.
And are there any questions being raised as to how he got a job as an airport shuttle driver?
I haven't heard that. I haven't heard anybody worrying about the fact that he was an airport bus driver, in effect. He also had a coffee cart in Manhattan. He really grew up in New York. He's only been in Colorado a few months. He had a coffee cart in Lower Manhattan. By all accounts, he's a very hardworking guy. But he got married to a woman in Peshawar, Pakistan. And it seems that in his travels to spend time with her in Pakistan, he had these encounters of some sort with al-Qaeda and seemed apparently willing to go be trained by them. We do expect additional terrorism charges to be filed, probably in the near term, against Zazi.
James Meek, national security reporter for the New York Daily News. James, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
to our conversation today. When you think of women with eating disorders, most of the media images are of young white women. Well, Stephanie Covington Armstrong says, think again. She is African American and traces her adult eating disorders to growing up in poverty in New York with a single mom whose cupboard was often bare and heart sometimes hard.
I would sneak food into my bed at night, clutching cookies and potato chip like a child's blanket, expecting it to soothe me to sleep. I still remember my excitement, the one time my mother sent me to the store for an Entenmann's coffee cake.
As an adult, Stephanie began binging and purging, but says because she was black, no one noticed. Her new memoir is called Not All Black Girls Know How to Eat, A Story of Bulimia. A warning, this may be a tender topic at times, both the bulimia and contributing factors like rape. And Stephanie Covington Armstrong joins us from the studios of NPR West. Stephanie, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Your childhood was one wild ride. But it's not that just you wanted for food. You know, you also wanted for what from your mom?
Affection, connection, nurturing.
Although we should say she worked very hard to support you. And
yes, try she to, always has.
Yeah, and try to see that you didn't have the childhood she had. She'd been in, was it an orphanage for a while
yes.
as a child? But still, she had to put you in foster care for a while when she couldn't make ends meet. And then there was another separation when she had a breakdown.
Yes.
What do you think this part of your childhood, where did that start to blend with your hunger for food?
I feel like I was born hungry, that there was just this need for something more that didn't show up, and it eventually became food.
Well, and I've just told a few chapters. When your mom gets out of Bellevue, she takes her family to Virginia, where she became involved with a white man in the Workers' Party. Then afterwards had a lesbian relationship. And neither of those things is at all a problem. But there was instability. There was a lot of change. There was going
yes.
from one thing to another. And did that instability in your mother's life also make you want some control in yours?
Absolutely. Growing up, I just thought, I want normal. I want, like, you watch TV and you see, like, the two parents and the kids and you know you're having dinner together and you know you're having this connection. So, yeah, that instability absolutely contributed to my need for control. What happened, though, is I became very much like my mother, very nomadic, prone to change, because I didn't understand how to sit through my feelings. So it was constant change in my adult life. Jobs, men, careers, like I was constantly looking for something externally.
Well, and there was perhaps something else chasing you, because, we've only told part of the childhood story. You were also raped by a beloved
yes.
uncle when you were just
yes.
12, and kept that a secret.
Absolutely. I knew if I told my mother, she'd kill him. I just thought it would cause her so much pain. His impression of my worth was so low that I kept thinking, well, maybe he's right. And that's what I ran from.
Well, and that led to a lot of acting out in high school, you know, getting in trouble, joining the cheerleaders, which sounds funny, you know, to be acting out. But, you know, considering that your mother was such an activist, she was appalled.
Yes, my mother was a communist. So that was...
Yeah,
that was as far to the right as I could go.
And doing things like going over to friends' houses to eat.
Yes. I was very slick in the sense that I picked people who had homes very different than mine, who had full refrigerators and who were welcoming of me, because I had good manners. So I was always invited over, and I'd go over to my friend's house after school. I know I could get a good meal. So yes, I was very, I was a survivor.
Yeah. Well, you not only survive, I'm going to leap ahead in your story. You would appear, on the outside at least, to thrive.
Yes.
You make it to Hollywood. You're auditioning.
Because it was
things,
the furthest I could run, as
yeah.
a matter of fact.
Oh, there you go.
I had a broken heart in New York, and I thought, I'm going to come to L.A., and I'm not going to feel the way I feel in New York.
Yeah. When did you first turn to throwing up?
I was in my early 20s. I, again, was suffering from a really... you know, acute broken heart. And I thought, enough. I don't want to feel anything. And I started to become a binger. So I had binge eating disorder. I was binging and binging and binging. And I'd always been small. I'd never had, like, weight issues. And suddenly my weight started creeping up. And I thought, well, if I'm fat, then people will know that I'm, like, not perfect. It was very important that that I had this secret, that you thought I was okay and that I was handling my life perfectly. And I was a complete mess. So I discovered bulimia, and it was perfect to me because I could shove down all these feelings and pain and shame, and then I could throw it up, and I wouldn't have any of the fallout.
You would do things to get your food. You would steal money from a dear friend to buy food.
Yes. And had I said, oh, can I have $100, it would have been no question. He would have just given it to me. But the shame of the disease is I didn't want to be found out.
Yeah. Well, and here's where you sort of started to become aware of the racism, as you write, the racism surrounding your disease. Describe that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I had such insane bulimic behavior. I'd eat tons of food, throw up, come back to the table, eat more food. Like, there was just an inability to stop eating and stop purging. And I knew that I could get away with it because I was black.
No. You write, because I was a black girl with natural hair who had grown up below the poverty line, no one ever suspected you could be bulimic because nobody ever heard of such a thing.
Yeah, and why would I waste food coming from where I come from?
Yeah, no one questioned why you ate 3 or 4 helpings per meal, why food went missing, why you never had any money because you were spending it on food. But then you enter a phase where you realize, oh, you got to get some help.
Well, I went to, I was on the subway in New York because I'd go back and forth. I'd move constantly. And I was reading the Village Voice, and on the back it said, if you're bulimic, we can fix you, basically. And I thought it was a quick fix, sounded perfectly, which was one of these guinea pig programs. And I went to one of the famous hospitals in New York. They were doing research on bulimia, and joined the program and started this process, except it was just a feeling that no matter what answers I gave to the questions, They were expecting something different because I was black. I mean, to the point where I just thought, okay, I need to just say I'm throwing up fried chicken and watermelon. Maybe you'll get it. Like, because I was just like a lab rat. There was so much curiosity.
In fact, people were coming, other doctors and people at the hospital were coming to look at you in this room where you were answering this questionnaire, and the doctor who was asking you the question said, oh, that's okay. We just don't see any African Americans in here.
Right.
On this issue.
Yeah. No, because we don't go to therapy. There's such a mistrust of white America, and most therapists are white, that we're not going to go and give our biggest secrets to someone that we don't trust, at least where I come from, especially on the lower socioeconomic ladder. Therapy is for crazy people. Like, where I come from, it's like, unless you're crazy, you don't go to therapy.
Yeah.
Unless you're going to be committed.
As your mother was.
So, yes.
That's Stephanie Covington Armstrong. Her new memoir is Not All Black Girls Know How to Eat. She's not alone, as we'll hear when we hear about recent studies in just 1 minute. Also, later today, Chicago is a toddling town. What does that mean? And will it help them win their Olympic bid? That's later. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We've been hearing the story of Stephanie Covington Armstrong. Her new memoir is Not All Black Girls Know How to Eat, A Story of Bulimia. Again, a warning. This is a tender topic at times, but Stephanie says it's imperative to talk about it because young girls, parents, doctors don't even know it's possible. Stephanie grew up hungry. She says she became a food binger and purger as an adult. And again, to the tender part, it was so bad at one point that she sliced her own tongue with a razor, hoping that would stop her compulsion. But it didn't. And Stephanie, you were telling us that doctors were perplexed, that you had this obsession. And you went to a support group meeting. You were one of the few African Americans there. And you write, it almost became your last meeting. Why? What happened there?
I walked into a 12-step meeting for food issues. It was a very brave thing. And I was sitting in the back. And finally, after like going to this meeting for a month, I got up to speak about my childhood of poverty and shame and about being raped as a kid and how I just couldn't stop eating. And I felt so much guilt because I was wasting money and how I wanted to stop. And then this very beautiful young blonde girl got up to speak right after me. And she said, I wish I was a poor black girl, because then I would understand why I was throwing up. I've always eaten. I've had a rich, you know, my parents buy me a new BMW every year. They pay for my apartment. I've never wanted for anything. And, you know, if I was a poor black girl, I could, maybe then I'd understand why I want to throw up my life. And I just went, it was like a knife. You know, she was saying, I don't understand why, you know, I would do this because I have everything and you have nothing.
When you could both have pain.
And that almost drove me out of the room. There's a huge USC study that was out last February, and it says that poor young black girls have a 50% higher chance of becoming bulimic than their white counterparts.
Why do you think it is, since you are one?
I think it's because as we become more aware of fitting in and being seen as a part of society, like an equal part of society, we're going to have a lot of the same problems. And I think there's so much guilt of wasting food and of failing at living up to the black archetype of the strong black woman. Like failing that is so painful. And there's a population of obesity in the black community. And I think a lot of young girls don't want to be obese. And our need for control. You're growing up in an environment where you are poor, your needs aren't being met, and you're hungry. It's what I went through. And there's a correlation, not always, I really want to be clear about this, but there is a correlation between sexual abuse and addiction.
Well, and I'm thinking that your experiences were 20 years ago. Young black and white girls today are sitting watching videos 24 hours a day, and they want to look like people who are being photoshopped.
Exactly. I just came from speaking at the National Eating Disorders Conference. They are starting a diversity task force to bring awareness to minorities. You know, it definitely feels like an uphill battle. I'm up for the task. I'm writing a new book, basically how to get to the other side.
Huh.
Because I think that's so important.
What did it for you?
It's a 12-step thing where they say when you get sick and tired of being sick and tired, you'll change. And one day in my mind, I kept thinking, the next thing is going to work, the next diet, the next day. And then it just, time and time again, of hitting my head against a brick wall, I realized I couldn't do it alone, which is very much a part of my culture. We don't talk about things and we suffer in silence. And I broke the code when I walked into those meetings and decided to stay. And I just, on my hands and knees, thought, I had a sister who was a drug addict. I saw the correlation. And I thought, I can't. I'll spend my life in the food. And I want my life back.
And you gave up the thing that, as horrible as it made you feel at times, there was also a moment, just a moment, sort of like a tingling or something.
This calm feeling would take over after I had a bulimic incident. It wasn't like I threw up a year ago because I was really sick. And I was like, oh, that's so painful. Like, yeah. It's not the same. And that was my coping mechanism. So I had to go to therapy, and I had to I kind of had a little bit of a spiritual awakening. I'd been raised an atheist. I'd never had any faith. So for me, it was like I had to do everything on my own alone. And so it was mental, spiritual, and physical that I had to heal.
If you had one thing to say to parents about what they should look for, what would it be?
Bulimia is so much about secretive behavior. If your child's not eating in front of you, or your child is consumed with thoughts of eating or not eating, those are the hallmarks. What a lot of people don't realize about bulimia is it's laxative abuse, it's diuretics, it's diet teas, and it's exercise abuse.
Have you heard from other, specifically African Americans, after having written the
book?
Yes. What do they say?
Yes, I've heard from a lot of young girls at black colleges, at white colleges. The number of emails I get on my website from young girls and parents now, it's overwhelming. You know, thank you for telling my story. I felt so isolated. I'm still struggling. How do I get help? Just like wanting to not feel alone.
That's Stephanie Covington Armstrong. Her book is Not All Black Girls Know How to Eat, A Story of Bulimia. We'll link you to her website at oursherenow.org. Stephanie, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Welcome, and thank you so much for having me. I so want people to understand how important this is, that we talk about this.
Okay. Let's just take a second to say we'd love to hear your thoughts on this or anything on the program. Just go to hereandnow.org and click on Contact Us to send an email. There's a phone number there as well. Or you can just scroll down and leave a comment right there on the homepage where it says comments. That's tomorrow. That's hereandnow.org. And tomorrow on Here and Now, a private academy causes an uproar, giving away all its library books and putting the library online. But isn't that where the kids are? That's tomorrow. And still ahead today, artist Alex Katz in the avant-garde in the 60s, in the J. Crew catalog in his 80s. That's after the latest news, Here and Now. Tomorrow, President Obama has an important speech to deliver, and for a change, it's not about health care. The president will try to convince world leaders gathered at a special UN session on climate change that his administration is serious about cutting emissions of gases that contribute to global warming, even while legislation to do just that is stalled in Congress. Let's check in there. Darren Samuelson is senior reporter for Environment and Energy News, an online news service. He joins us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Darren, this is a president, as we said, tackling health care, but also the economy. Two ongoing conflicts or questions about what more he can take on, but are expectations high?
Everyone is very much looking forward to what President Obama has to say. This is really the first time that he'll have addressed such a large crowd to talk about climate change, which was one of the key pieces of his campaign agenda, no doubt, last year.
Well, isn't there some concern about the possibility of a U.S. commitment, given everything else that's going on?
There certainly is. In the United States Congress right now, you do have a House-passed bill, which was a big hurdle for Democrats to cross. But in the Senate, things are stuck right now. We're waiting for committees to start producing bills, just like in healthcare. And Harry Reid, the majority leader in the Senate, has kind of hinted that this bill could get punted into 2010, which is another part of this Congress, and nothing really cancels out yet. But to not have the momentum going here in these final months of the year has everybody wondering if the Congress is really going to get behind what President Obama wants to do.
Ahead lies international negotiations in Copenhagen, Denmark in December. The current treaty, the Kyoto Protocol, expires in 2012. Is the thinking that the U.S. will go to those meetings in December with some progress or not?
Yes, they'll definitely have progress. In the last 9 months, there's just been a whirlwind of activity here in Washington from the regulatory standpoint. The United States Environmental Protection Agency has been moving to implement a 2007 Supreme Court decision that at the time really was a rebuke to the Bush administration, which was fighting against regulations of greenhouse gases. Just this last week, President Obama and the United States Environmental Protection Agency actually finalized standards for greenhouse gas emissions from the tailpipe. So the auto industry is taking some, the first emission cuts. And Obama's going to be able to bring that to Copenhagen. He'll be able to point to the House-passed legislation. And I think now what the administration is hopeful for is at least getting some Senate committees to mark up their version of a bill. And combined, you can sort of collectively put that into a package and say, look, this is what the goalposts look like for the United States. And it's pretty aggressive compared to, where we were last year under President Bush. And, these are negotiations that are fluid that will not end in Copenhagen. They'll continue on into 2010 and beyond. This has been going on since 1992, these negotiations. So it's not like Copenhagen is the end-all, be-all.
In fact, 3 weeks before Copenhagen, President Obama goes to China, and people are looking for signals from China. What are they going to do? Congressman James Sensenbrenner from Wisconsin wants to know why the U.S. should cut emissions 17% by 2020, which is what the House bill calls for, when there are projections that China will raise its emissions 30% by that same date. So what's expected from the meeting?
Well, the United States and China have been working behind the scenes for about a year now since Obama came into office, trying to figure out how the two countries, which are historically responsible now, are responsible now for well over half of the world's emissions, trying to figure out if there's a way that these two big, gorillas can collectively reduce their emissions. And what that means is, a little bit of tit for tat here. Maybe there's going to be some sharing of technologies. There's going to be some financial assistance going from the United States to China. And in return, the Chinese are going to be expected to make emission reductions, not at the absolute level that a developed country like the United States would, maybe not a binding way, which there's going to be some big sticking points and questions from back home here in Washington. Well, should we really trust the Chinese to taking a voluntary commitment given all the other disputes that happen with the Chinese, whether it be over currency or toys or tires now? There's all sorts of other trade-related issues and monetary financial issues that overlap here.
Darren Samuelson, he reports on the politics of climate change for Environment and Energy News. Darren, thanks so much for setting the table for us for the next couple of months.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as if President Obama doesn't have enough on his hands, there's also a push for him to make a personal bid to bring the Olympics to his adopted hometown, Chicago. We'll have that story in 30 seconds, here and now. A special welcome to our new listeners at WBEZ Chicago Public Radio, many of whom we know are hanging on word from the International Olympic Committee as to whether Chicago will win the 2016 Summer Olympics. The IOC meets in Copenhagen in 2 weeks to decide between Chicago, Madrid, Tokyo, and Rio de Janeiro, which would become the first South American Olympics. It's expected to be close. Of course, there are Chicagoans who don't want the Olympics, even though the city says half of all tickets will cost $50 or less, and it will be subway and bus accessible. Others, like NPR's Scott Simon, are campaigning for it. But will President Obama have to do that as well? Philip Hirsch is sports writer for the Chicago Tribune. Phil, Barack Obama has said he's too busy to go right now. Michelle Obama will go instead. But Tony Blair personally lobbied the IOC and won the upcoming Olympics for London. So is the thinking no President Obama, no deal?
No, I don't think it's a question of no President Obama, no deal. It's a question that President Obama's presence could help. I don't think that his not going will necessarily be the decisive factor, but I think his going could actually sway one or two votes, and one or two votes may be enough to make the difference.
Well, we'll sell the city. You know, what are Chicagoans saying they have that, say, Rio doesn't?
Well, the strength of Chicago's bid is that it would be the first Olympics that I remember, and I go back to 1980, where the entire major concentration of things would be smack in the heart of the city, where you could walk from an event to a museum to a restaurant, back to a museum, back to an event.
Yeah.
And that central city location is critical, the critical strength of their bid.
And we understand the Chicago won't have to build much beyond maybe a new pool and a temporary Olympic stadium. What are they going to do with that?
Well, the park that they're putting the stadium in, Washington Park, is a historic park. It's a Frederick Law Olmsted Park, and there's actually been some controversy about even doing anything that changes the landscape of that park. So they didn't want to leave an enormous structure in the park, number one. Number two, Chicago doesn't need another big outdoor stadium. So they've got a plan for a temporary stadium, which would be 80,000 seats during the Olympics, approximately 5,000 to 10,000 seats afterwards, and which could be a template for other Olympic cities that also may not need another large new stadium, which can become a white elephant.
Well, and Chicago, of course, gave the world Al Capone, a whole line of very colorful politicians charged with corruption, most recently former Governor Rob Blagojevich. And as we said, that's very colorful, but it's also raised some concerns. So just tell us a little bit about money. We understand the operating budget, $5 billion. That doesn't include money for road improvements. Where's the money coming from and where's it going?
Well, the money would come from a variety of sources, sponsorships, the share of the international sponsorships and the international television rights that each host city gets. There'll be some fundraising. There'd be some naming rights of venues for after the Olympics because the International Olympic Committee doesn't allow venues to have corporate names during the Olympic Games. Mm. Ticket sales and a number of things. So the $1 billion Olympic Village would be privately developed, and therefore that $1 billion, which has to obviously be covered, but it would not come from any of those other sources.
Well, and Phil, it just reminds me, we'll be speaking to you again because we're kind of hoping that Chicago gets the bid as well, but it also has such wonderful country leaders. It has Oprah, you know. Is there a sense that, you know, if President Obama can't go, maybe she will?
Well, she has told the people at the Chicago 2016 bid committee that she is willing to go if they really want her there. And one of the things that has struck me as a non-watcher of Oprah was talking to people around the world over the last 6 or 7 months is the amount of recognition she has worldwide. It was far greater than I would have suspected. I would have thought she was more a U.S. phenomenon, but it's clear that everybody around the world knows Oprah.
There's this thing called satellites, come to find out. Philip Hirsch, sports writer for the Chicago Tribune, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
And that's Trafalgar Square on July 6, 2005, when London was awarded the 2012 Summer Olympics. It was a competition worthy of a gold medal after the other finalists, New York, Madrid, and Moscow, were eliminated. London edged Paris by only 4 votes at the International Olympic Committee meeting in Singapore. Today, construction of the Olympic Stadium is underway, and the taxpayer-funded budget for the London Games has soared to more than $15 billion. Gordon Farquhar is the BBC's Olympics correspondent. He's in London. Gordon, you know, earlier we just mentioned that British Prime Minister Tony Blair had this role in London's winning the Games. What did he do to tip the scales?
I think what was important about Tony Blair was that he was prepared to do as he was asked, which was basically do a bit of a sell of London. That's what he did. I mean, he saw something like 25 IOC members in the 48 hours before the votes. They all came to his room. He sat them down. He looked them in the eyes and he said, you know, London's not such a bad place. You might want to think about London. And that was generally seen to be a very important and possibly a crucial contribution, actually, to London's success.
Was it just the force of his personality?
Tony Blair's always been very good at the ordinary bloke thing. He was also very much not Jacques Chirac, because of course Chirac turned up to support the Paris bid and he arrived in trouble, having been criticising English cooking and Finnish cooking as well, as he turned up and he was being chased around about that, and they're all off to the G8 summit shortly afterwards, and he was very much sort of chasing his tail around a little. So Chirac arrived as the statesman and didn't stay around to talk to people, whereas Blair did, and I think the ordinary touch that Blair was able to put over was helpful to London.
Well, we understand the London Olympic Committee also sent kids to the meeting. What'd they do?
They were part of the message, the crucial message which London managed to chime with the members, which was to say, these kids are the future. I mean, it's pretty obvious, but they did it in a way in which they didn't make it look too twee.
Excuse me, too twee?
Yeah, twee as in kind of a bit syrupy and a bit... You see what I mean? They weren't there to just look like cute kids. They were there to be representative of the idea that this was about the future of sport and this was the IOC's future. So you had all these elderly men in grey suits in the hall looking at these young kids, and the idea was to sort of make them remember their own childhoods and say, look, you know, this is about the excitement of sport. These people are the sporting future of the country. Do it for them.
Well, on a serious note, we're also reminded the celebrations in London after the announcement London received the Games were cut short by the transit system bombings. Less than 24 hours later, more than 50 people killed. But more than 4 years have passed since then. So what's the public thinking? Is there fear about the Olympics, or is there a sense that everything's uprighted again?
I think the fear is gone. I think, interesting, I don't think really anybody ever seriously thought perhaps we shouldn't be doing the Olympics. And then, of course, arguments over what it was all going to cost kind of took over. So that diverted everybody's attention away from their personal safety to their back pockets. And I think 4 years on from then, things are pressing ahead as planned.
Gordon Farquhar, the BBC's Olympics correspondent in London. Gordon, thanks so much, and we'll, you know, get back to you in 2012.
It's a pleasure.
Meanwhile, we have this conversation again as Chicago makes its bid for the 2016 Summer Olympics. We mentioned earlier Chicago, as we all know, is that toddle in town in the song of the same name. If you know what that means, please let us know. You just go to hereandnow.org. And while you're there, remember you can always listen to our program stream live. You can download a podcast, take us with you wherever we go. That's hereandnow.org. And before we go today, artist Alex Katz, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. Recently, hundreds of well-heeled art patrons joined aspiring art students in a standing ovation for American artist Alex Katz. Alex Katz is best known for his bright, everyday scenes at the beach or a backyard barbecue, and a signature flat style that reads like commercial art and predated pop art. A piece this summer on Katz in the Smithsonian Magazine was titled Alex Katz is Cooler Than Ever, and he's here at Boston's Museum of Fine Arts to receive the museum school's highest tribute for his work, from the avant-garde in the 60s to his role as a suave model in a J. Crew catalog in his 80s.
Alex Katz, for museum school students, you're a paragon of cool. I am proud to recognize your many contributions to us all and honor you, Alex Katz, with the Medal of the School of the Museum of Fine Arts. Oh.
Well, thank you for the medal. Thank you all for coming. And it's just been a terrific trip.
Alex Katz cuts quite a figure, tall, thin, a bald head that he shaves every day. And for the next hour, I was privileged to speak with him about his start in Brooklyn, his discovery of plein air, outdoor painting up in Maine, the influence of his wife Ada, and the work. A slideshow ran behind us. You can see pictures at our website, hereandnow.org. We began with a huge self-portrait, a young man in a black suit and dapper hat.
Your self-portrait. Who is that young man?
The young man was impersonating an uptown person. I didn't think who I was important. I thought the image was important. Working on large faces was new. Using an up-to-date image was new, so that was what it was about. You know, I wanted to just get to the surface.
Get to the surface. You said that, I think you just said you were... didn't have the sense of yourself or something like that. And I liked reading that when you were a kid in Brooklyn, was it? Accepted to Cooper Union?
Mm-hmm.
You were shocked.
Absolutely. I went to a trade school, and I didn't know much about modern art. I thought I'd go into advertising or something like that to make a living.
I've read you described as a realist who came of age during abstract expressionism, and then another critic referred to your work as a Hercules movie starring Steve Reeves. How would you describe what we're seeing, what evolved?
When I wanted to work with contemporary gestures, and most of the gestures that I was involved with, like people drinking and smoking. You know, I'm not going to use gestures from Paris.
Is there American?
So I started with what was in front of me, and I want to use contemporary gestures, contemporary clothes, and contemporary people. It was socially all the people I was seeing at the time, more or less. I just invited them up and painted them.
So many of the pictures seem to be social interaction. Someone said light conversation, sunny backyards. Why is it important to you to capture that?
Well, it's the world I live in, just like that. And, okay. When I was real young, this older guy, was about 2 years older, Dick Crockett, wanted to be a commercial artist. And he said, let's take a bike ride and find a thing and do watercolors. So I said, swell. So I went out and did watercolors and came back, showed them to my father. And my father said, Dick, you're going to be a great commercial artist. And he was. He looked at my thing, you're going to have to be a fine artist. But it was pretty inept, is what he was telling me. And then he compounded it by saying, why don't you paint your own backyard? Which is extremely intelligent, and I resented it a great deal. I couldn't see a picture in the backyard. All I saw was a mess. Yeah. And so I kept the idea, seemed like a really good idea. Paint your backyard, paint what's in front of you, and don't paint anyone else's backyard.
Yeah.
I mean, it's 59. You can't imagine what these paintings were like when they were new. They were a real shock to people. People were screaming at me, and people wouldn't talk to me, and people liked them.
Why? What were they saying?
They're heartless. They're illustrations, you know? And other people started to pick up on them.
I just want to mention of Ada, an art historian wrote of her that she's woman, wife, mother, muse, model, hostess, myth, icon, and New York goddess.
That's all true. A perfect model. You know, she saw a lot of movies and digested all the images, so she never makes a bad gesture.
Could you speak to the two-dimensional aspect of the paintings? Is it difficult to keep things two-dimensional? Do you have to resist a pull to give it more depth or make it less flat?
No, I try to make a painting, like, I'm trying to get that painting out at you as strongly and as fast as possible. It's very quick and they go out very fast. And you're absolutely right with the two-dimensional, yeah. It's all about appearance. I'm trying to show you what I think everything looks like. You know, reality is a variable. And you see through the eyes of your culture, and it changes every, you know, 20, 30 years. And I'm trying to be on top.
I want to just touch on the fact that you discovered plein air in Maine, this idea of painting outdoors, and you said that this kind of back of your head painting was a high.
Well, yeah, because, you know, you start off with, like, antique drawing, And then you go to cubism, which is very much like antique drawing. And this stuff is all a blast. You just paint unconscious.
Is that what you mean, back of your head?
Yeah, you're painting from your unconscious brain. And for my personality, which is pretty analytic, it was like really getting to another place.
Do you recommend that young artists...
No, I think
nothing.
I think you have to find your own temperament. You have to find out who you are and adjust the whole thing to yourself.
In fact, I think I read somewhere else that you say it takes about 8 to 10 years for a painter to become a painter, and then another 10 years to become a master.
Yeah. The thing with painting is it takes us 6-7 years out of art school till you get your stuff together. And if you've really got talent and energy to become a master, it usually 35, 40.
Well, make that distinction for us with you. When did you realize that you were the master of your craft?
I think sometime in my 30s, I think people started thinking I was, you know.
How does that feel?
It doesn't help you with the next
painting.
It
doesn't help you with the next painting. Alex Katz, we have a couple more images. The J. Crew catalog. We have to see the J. Crew catalog. Now, what are you thinking when they ask you to do this? And boy, do you look great in that, actually.
Well, I know about posing. And it's a dynamite photographer, and I knew what he wanted, and I'm giving him what he wants.
Yeah. Right. Even though, do you feel like that?
I don't know. Feeling has nothing to do with it.
No,
I know what I look like. When you paint a dancer or someone who sort of knows what they sort of tell you what they're going to look like. I think I have enough experience to be able to do that to a degree.
You know, I should know this, but it's escaped me. How old are you now?
81. And that was the whole trick of the thing.
That was great. I'm just wondering, you said we're going to close soon, and what do you try to capture now?
I'm chasing images all the time.
All the time.
You have ideas, and all of a sudden you see something, and that's an image. And when you see an image, I know I'll get a painting, you know?
Yeah.
You just see it, and it goes pop, and you say, wow. It's like real intuitive. It's like a flash.
Andrew Wyeth told me it was the hair on the back of his head.
No, I can't say that.
Alex Katz, thank you so much for sharing your time.